to miss you guys.
Yeah. Okay.
I wasn't sure if you overslept.
I didn't fall asleep till 6 a.m.
Oh my goodness.
It was fun yesterday.
Well, that's impressive that you're here. Yeah, that's right? Really impressive.
Must be a good class.
Okay, so everybody has the handout. This was the one that I wanted to bring you from last week. And just a couple of things. In that first review on the top by Andrew O'Hare, he says, but Perlman's perceptions, he's not 100% sold on her, but Perlman's perceptions are so sharp and so fair-minded that I can't resist her. She neither wants to attack the lives her characters lead nor defend them, only to capture them as honestly as she can. And that's important for our story today, not to attack them or defend them, but just to tell the story. And then, if you go down to a drop in distinction, the second paragraph, Perlman plays around with the characters in this collection, forces them through an array of diverse circumstances from which they return either rejuvenated or depleted. The story I saw, which we read last week, deals with the dangers of newfound vanity when Franny, a local newspaper writer, discovers contact lenses. Just skip to the next paragraph. The collection is told with a sense of urgency, a spring in its step. Perlman studies her characters with precision, reveals their quirks with casual ease, and draws the reader into a world that is as exciting as it is life-altering. Some of these reviewers are good writers. okay, so here's the, turn over to the other side. This is an interview with Edith Perlman, and here's where she talks a little bit about her writing. Harriet, we'll just take a paragraph and go around.
What is your earliest memory of being enchanted by words? My favorite aunt taught me to read when I was 4. Though I then was able to read alone, we still read together. Poetry, fairy tales, Kipling. My stage-struck mother played and sang show tunes. My father sang Russian lullabies. It was an enchanted and wordy household.
In retrospect, has writing later and now offered something unexpected? Yes, I would describe that something as a way of seeing the world as rich, eventful, tragic, comic, and ultimately inexplicable, and a conviction that everyone, even people who seem dull or sluggish or small-minded, can be observed and gotten to know and eventually lend part of themselves to some composite character or incident. When I first started to write, I wrote mostly about people I knew. My population is more varied now.
One of the topics on which you frequently speak includes superiority of the typewriter over the computer. Could you elaborate? Mm-hmm. Is it the tactile proximity, greater focus the typewriter affords, or is it more to do with a writer's perspective on essential issues? It's the fact that revising, I do endless revisions typing and then scrolling on the typescript and then typing again, requires that within whatever paragraph or page is now being retyped, every word must present itself for reevaluation, prove itself worthy. Thoughtless deletions, idle copies and paste, they're just not available in my own Hermes. Thank heaven, I might add, the computer, I think, is no aid to prose. Yes, there is a need for patience, and also for taking the time to be brief.
Taking the time to be brief. The typewriter forces her to go slower. Mm-hmm. And that beautiful sentence that she spoke, every word must present itself for reevaluation, prove itself worthy. Because that's, you know, and you can see the attention. And then, Madeline, do you want to just finish this
sure.
up?
What non-literary sources inspire your work? People, books, pictures, places, the workings of chance, memory, and dream.
Yeah. So,
Tom Hanks just was speaking on NPR this morning about the typewriter.
And it was on that article. Was it in the...
Was it New York Times article about it? Yeah.
It was on California typewriter?
This past Sunday.
It's a book, he wrote a book about short stories.
Oh, wait, so I
was talking about his obsession with a typewriter.
There was that documentary that was here that he directed and was part of about people who are obsessed with typewriters. To go back to the old history. Someone collected only the old ones. And he has a whole collection of them. And then other writers
very
use them and why they won't use the computer.
So there you go.
He wrote his book on the computer, even though he
owns even though,
typewriter. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
So, no, so so she's not alone in terms of her appreciation for the typewriter. Okay, the other thing was the endless revisions. You know, she basically shows you, like, you can see her doing what she's doing and so on. So always a great little window into the process. Okay, mates. What are mates?
But they're friends.
They can be friends. What else?
Helpers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Great. What else?
Partners.
They can be spouses. You know. I mean, they can be. You know, your mate in that sense. So partners, friends. It can be an intimate relationship or not an intimate relationship. My mate over there, you know, who's not, you know. So mates. So we hear about a set of mates. Let's see. Sandra, do you want to read the first paragraph?
Keith and Masuko Maigari drifted into town like hobos, though the rails they rode were only the trolley tracks from Boston. And they paid their fares like everyone else.
Okay, so I'm sorry. Just Keith and Mitsuko Maguire drifted into town like hobos, right? So she makes this nice comparison. And then what happens? But they're not like hobos. In other words, they pay for their ride. They, you know, they're not like hobos, but they're like hobos. So, you know, from of course, the first sentence, she tries to characterize them, but then she can't. They don't fit into that, you know, the box that we want to put them in. And also, Mitsuko Maguire. You know, there in itself, like, what's going on there? Okay. So they're like hobos, but they're not. Okay, let's continue.
But they seemed as easy as vagabonds, without even a suitcase between them, and only one hat, a canvas cap. They took turns putting it on. Each wore a hiker's back frame fitted with a sleeping bag and a knapsack. Two lime green sneakers hung from the Suko's pack.
Okay, so now if you can remember when you were when you were reading this story, what did you think after that first paragraph, if you can remember?
That they were just drifters.
Mm-hmm.
Which obviously isn't what happened.
Traveling light.
Yeah.
Traveling light. Yeah.
The last thing they were going to do is rent a place because they had a sleeping bag and whatever.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It was the putting on and the taking off of the hat that struck me. I thought that was such an interesting detail.
Yeah. And the sneakers.
Yeah.
And the sneakers, the lime green sneakers, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Well, you guys are all much more generous than I was. you know, I read this and I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be about a story about people who can't commit and so on. And, you know, it's all good. But she does kind of, she just, you know, tells us about them. If you were going to jump to judgment, you know, a vagabond can have a pejorative, you know, nuance. What else could have a pejorative nuance here?
Hobos.
Hobos can, yeah. Yeah, okay. That's good. So they're drifters. They don't mind sharing a hat. Okay. So that's what we know about them. Lime green. Yeah. Barry, do you want to keep going?
That afternoon, they were seen sharing a loaf and a couple of beers on a bench in
Logwood's Park. Love that.
Afterwards, they relaxed under a beech tree with their paper bags. They looked as if they meant to camp there. Sleeping outside was as illegal 25 years ago as it is today. And these newcomers, it turned out, honored the law.
In fact, they spent their first night in the Godolphin Inn like ordinary travelers. They spent their second night in the apartment that they had just rented at the top of a three-decker on Lewis Street, around the corner from the house I have lived in since I was a girl.
Okay, so we've just met our narrator. Just kind of, she kind of like slips her right in there. But what do we learn now that we know that she's our narrator? What do we learn about her from that second paragraph?
She's observant.
Yes, yes, like a hawk.
That's what the laws are.
Right.
And she's not judgmental.
Knows what the laws
are. I didn't think she was judgmental at all. She wasn't saying anything really negative about him.
She's not. But they were seen, they looked as if, these newcomers, you're totally right. Nothing in itself, but... what does newcomers tell you?
Strangers.
Different.
Small town.
There's the possibility, right, of it, right, small, because she knows that they're newcomers, so, right, so it could just be that it's a small, it's a neighborhood.
So is this taking place 25 years ago, and she's writing about it 25 years since?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, right, right. Because it says there they stay for a quarter century. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, as illegal then as it is today. So she's writing this 25 years after the fact.
Right, right.
Not much happens there.
Right.
When she
right.
About it today.
Right.
But also the word like. It's like hobos, like ordinary travelers.
Yes. They were seen, they looked as... So our narrator, who's very observant, says, well, it may be that, what is it, what is she implying by saying they were seen or they looked as if?
Well, she's suspicious of them.
Yeah.
So she also says it turned out. That was another key thing in here. It turned out that they were okay, but I wasn't so sure.
Right, right, because it turned out honored the law. You know, the assumption there is the newcomers won't. Even if you say it's because they don't know the law of the particular place. There's a very, very gentle possible suspiciousness that our narrator.
Or it could be just snoops and just
right.
Always right. Watching, what was her name? Kravitz across the street.
Mrs. Kravitz.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right. And you know those neighbors who are, who are looking out the window all the time. And Edith Perlman writes about that a fair amount of people who are observing their neighbors.
But these are triple deckers, and I grew up in it. Two-family house, and a three-decker, and you're always close. You're there, and you're in everybody's face, and you know what's happening everywhere.
Right.
So I think it made perfect sense.
It could be.
I was very comfortable with it.
Okay, good, 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 good.
What my neighbors were doing, anyways, and we knew who was who was moving in and who was with who.
Okay, great. And there they stayed for a quarter century. Maintaining cordial relations with the downstairs landlord and with the succession of families who occupied the middle flat. Okay. Is this also just? I mean, she's telling us these things for a reason. What is she telling us?
It turned out to be okay.
They're okay, but they maintain cordial relationships. It means, what does that mean?
It
means
not too intimate.
We don't know our neighbors, right? I mean, we know them enough to say hello on the elevator, but we don't ask them about their kids, right? So they maintain cordial relations. Again, Ruth is right. It could be just, they were good people. And so they were cordial to everybody. Okay. But we'll get a hint in a little bit that it's not just... cordiality as a nice thing. Okay. Lynn, do you want to read Every Fall They Planted?
Every fall they planted tulips in front. In the spring, Keith mowed the side lawn. Summers, they raised vegetables in the back. All three apartments shared the bounty.
Ah, okay. So they were sharers. Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
anyone else in their position would have bought a single-family house or condo, maybe after the first child, certainly after the second. Keith, a welder, made good money, and Mitsuko, working part-time as a computer programmer, supplemented their income. The McGuires kept on paying rent as if there were no such thing as equity. They own no television, and their blender had only although the net curtains at their windows seemed a thing of the moment, like a bridal veil, their plain oak furniture had a responsible thickness. On hooks in the back hall hung the kids' rain gear and Keith's hard hat and Mitsuko's sneakers. The sneakers' green color darkened with wear. Eventually, she bought a pair of this one.
Okay, so what she talks about the curtains and the oak furniture. So is she just telling us about the furniture?
They were plain. They were simple people.
Simple people. What is it to have a responsible thickness?
Sturdiness.
Yes, in other words, it's like it doesn't fold up. It's not a folding dresser that I can put on my back. A responsible thickness. What's the bridal veil?
Temporary.
Can be temporary,
or
right?
Starting into a long relationship too.
Oh, she's good. She's okay. We're gonna see this. It can also be, you know, a veil is something that covers something up, right? So, you know, again, the possibility of, you know, something good or maybe something not.
Well, she knew that the blender only had 3 speeds. I mean, somehow or another, someone had been in this house, you know.
Right, right.
From the outside, they were cordial.
Right. And what does that tell, but what do these things tell you?
They're not materialistic. They're not buying the newest.
Not accumulating.
Right,
and they're not laying down roots either by not buying a house and paying month by month or whatever, that they're keeping their options open.
Right. But also they're willing to defy norms, you know. So in that sense, they're willing to, you know, they have their own ideas and they have their own thoughts. No television, blender with only 3 speeds.
Wouldn't the veil be, it's not completely shutting out everyone.
Right. Yes.
They're not completely shut off from
everyone. Right. No, and they do, you know, they share their they share their vegetables. They do normal things that people do. You know, they're employed and so on and so forth. Okay. And now we come a little bit more to her relationship with them. Judy?
I taught all 3 of the boys. By the time the oldest entered 6th grade, he was a passionate soccer player. The second, the bookish one, wore glasses. The third, a cut-up, was undersized. With each son, the mother's eastern eyes looked out of the father's Celtic face. A simple, comely, repeated visage, a glyph meaning child.
Okay. Yeah, we'll pause here for a second. Yeah. Okay. So, she taught them. She was their teacher, right? And she can tell you a little bit about each, right?
And now it makes sense how she knows about them, because she lived around the corner and she wasn't.
Right.
But the blender. How does she know about the blender?
She was invited over.
Right. So what does she know about them? She taught all 3 of the boys.
She's talking about their vision, their face, their how they look. The combination of the mother and father physically, visually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she knew both parents.
Right. Mm-hmm. And she knows the oldest one's passion, mm-hmm. right? And that was not something that had to do with the classroom. That's outside the classroom. She knows that the third one was a cut-up, was undersized. Okay, so she has, you know, there's a relationship there. Okay, let's keep going. Judy?
Mitsuko herself was not much bigger than a child. When the youngest began high school, even he had outstripped his mother. Her little face contained a soft beige mouth, a nose of no consequence, and those mild eyes. Her short hair was clipped every month by Keith. In return, Mitsuko trimmed Keith's receding curls and husky beard. She wore tees and jeans and sneakers, except for public occasions. Then she wore a plum-colored skirt and a white silk blouse. I think it was always the same skirt and blouse. The school doctor once referred to her as generic, but when I asked him to identify the genus, he sighed his fat sigh. Female parent? All I mean is that she's stripped down. I agree. It was as if nature had given her only the essentials. Flat little ears, binocular vision, teeth strong enough for buffalo steak, although they were required to deal with nothing more fibrous than apples and raw celery. Mitsuko's cuisine was vegetarian. Her breasts swelled to the size of teacups when she was nursing, then receded. The school doctor's breasts, sometimes visible under a summer shirt, were slightly bigger than
Interesting what our narrator notices.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, what do we know about Mitsuko from this whole thing?
She's tiny.
She's very petite.
How'd she carry the backpack? How did she wander around with her backpack with all that stuff on it?
Yeah.
Very light.
Was luminary strong.
Well,
and that's why she only had one skirt and one blouse.
Right. What does that mean? A nose of no consequence. It may not be
unremarkable.
Yeah, unremarkable. Mm-hmm. Right.
Generic, like.
Yeah. The thing is that, our narrator talks about a nose of no consequence, but for somebody in the world. That part of a face, that face is really, really significant, when she looks, she sees a nose of no consequence, but to somebody else, that nose is very, very important.
Yeah, I just meant it was a small nose, it wasn't like
Okay, Ruth, do you want to keep? Oh, wait. No, there are a few other things. So we find her next that she has a friend, sort of, our narrator.
The school doctor.
The school doctor, right? What about their little interchange about generic and genus? I mean, they end up agreeing, but she's pushing him a little bit, right? By saying, okay, you're saying that she's sort of bland and nothing, but let's take your word, the word that you've used. And that's something very specific. Okay. Ruth, keep going.
The McGuires attended no church. They registered independent. They belonged to no club. But every year they helped organize a spring block party and the fall park cleanup. Mitsuko made filigree cookies for school bake sales, and Keith served on the search committee when the principal retired. When their eldest was in my class, each gave a What I Do talk to the sixth grade. At my request, they repeated it annually. Wearing a belt stuffed with tools, his mask in his hands, Keith spoke of welding's origins in the forge. He mentioned weapons, tools, automobiles. He told us of the smartness of the wind, the sway of the scaffolding, the friendly heft of the torch. An arc flames and then burns blue, he said. Steel bar fuses to steel bar. Mitsuko and her appearances before the class also began with history. She described Babbage's first calculating machine, whose innards nervously clacked. She recapitulated the invention of the Hollerith code. The punch card she showed the kids seemed as venerable as papyrus. The cathode tube, the microchip. Then she, too, turned personal. My task is to achieve intimacy with the computer, she said, to follow the twists of its thought, to help it become all it can. When leaving, she turned at the doorway and gave us the hint of a bow.
Okay. So what do we learn about Keith and Mitsuko?
Very different from one another.
Right, very different. And how so? How are they so different?
Sentence steel bar fuses to steel bar stood out for me in terms of needs, but his images are all tough and strong and resilient, and hers are of the mind and ethereal.
Yeah, clacking.
But then it says, then she too turned personal. I don't see how he turned personal.
Well, so.
I think it is personal. You think he did? He was kind of explaining his connection with his tools and what he did and how it impacted him, and it was very poetic.
Oh, okay.
I think steel bar fuses to steel bar is the personal.
Say that again?
Is the personal.
Oh, yeah.
The personal, right, and it's the smartness of the wind, and it's the friendliness of the torch, and the sway of the scaffolding. So it's not like he, you know, he gave this thing about, you know, this is X, Y, and Z. You know, he used adjectives, which is about his relationship with it. So he has some appreciation of his, of his craft in a deeper way.
But he had, it's each of their inner lives, which you haven't seen anything of up to this point.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So we have a touch of that. But
I also thought it was a surprise. Then she too turned personal.
Yeah.
So I was expecting her to say something about her Asian origins, and you know, she talks about the computer, and it's only when she leaves does anything of her culture come into play.
Yeah. What does that mean? My task is to achieve intimacy with the computer.
To follow the twist of its thought, computers think. I mean, what?
Yeah, you know, this is personal for her. This is how, you know, she is talking about intimacy, but look who the intimacy is with.
Well, both of them.
But, right.
Yeah, both of them.
To help it become all it can.
Well, and to fuse steel to steel. I mean, yeah, this is exactly the same. Their mates there.
Yeah. Okay. So, there was one other thing back on that other page. Oh, right. The net curtains at the window seem a thing of the moment, while the plain oak was a responsible thickness. So there are some there are paradoxes with them, right? Because you know, things are not just. Things are just are not that I could interpret this in two ways. It's also that there are things that don't seem to mesh with each other. Okay. Many townspeople knew the McGuires. Julie?
Many townspeople knew the McGuires. How could they not? With the boys going to school and making friends and playing sports, their household had the usual needs: shots and checkups, medications, vegetables, hardware. The kids bought magazines and notebooks at Dunton's Tobacco. Every November, Keith and his sons walked smiling into Roberta's Linens and bought a new Belgian handkerchief for Mitsuko's birthday. During the following year's special occasions, its lace would foam from the pocket of the white silk blouse.
Okay.
Keep going?
Yeah, just one more.
But none of us knew them well. They didn't become anyone's intimates. And when they vanished in a wink. One day we heard that the youngest was leaving to become a doctor. The next day, or so it seemed, the parents had decamped.
It's a good word, decamped, given there. Mm-hmm. Right. So many townspeople knew the McGuires, but did they know the McGuires? Did anybody know the McGuires?
And he has no imagination. Every year he buys her the same thing. 25 years she lived there, right?
Right, right. So that can seem, you know, if you look at that, you can say no imagination, not taking any time to really think about that she might possibly like something else.
But it's portable. It's nothing that they have to leave.
Right, right. Right.
And it's something like the sneakers that does wear out after you wash it.
Right.
You
know. But not like.
Maybe she really loves having a new one.
Yeah. So, okay, so that's true. Maybe she loves, maybe this is exactly what she loves. Absolutely. Right. So we don't know, but none of us knew them well. They didn't become anyone's intimates. Is that a trustworthy statement? I think it kind of is in a small place, in the sense of, in small villages, people know who people are connected with. You know, they may not know the nature of the connection and so on, but somehow they know which steel bar is which with which steel bar, right? But none of us knew them well. They didn't become anyone's intimates. So you could read that as an indictment of them, you know, to come, you know, to not delve fully into the potential for human relationships. Okay, possibly.
But they had their own family.
They do. They absolutely
so
do.
They have that community.
Right.
And they were cordial.
Yes. Yeah. Cordial nothing. Yeah. Absolutely. Right.
They also contributed.
They contributed.
He did the planting outside the house, and they did the fairs.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm.
Someone thought enough of him to let him be on the committee to choose the new principal. That's right. Right. Mm-hmm. It's got to be an honor, even in a small town, right?
Right. Right. And, Connie, did you want to say something? The thing is that, you know, all of this description of maybe cordial unremarkableness, this is the focus of her story, right? This is the focus of her story. And so we'll keep that in mind when we go to look at the story of a whole. Okay. Ilana, I had seen Mitsuko.
I had seen Mitsuko the previous week. She was buying avocados at the greengrocer. She told me that she mixed them with cold milk and chocolate in the blender. The drink is pale green, like a dragonfly, she said. Very refreshing. Yes, the youngest was off to medical school. The middle son was teaching carpentry in Oregon. The oldest, a journalist in Minnesota, was married and the father of twin girls. So she had granddaughters. She was close to 50, but she still could have passed for a teenager. You had to peer closely under the pretext of examining pineapples together to see a faint cross-hatching under the eyes. But there was no gray in the cropped hair, and the body in jeans and tee was that of a stripling. She chose the final avocado. I am glad to have run into you, she said with her usual courtesy. Even later, I could not call this remark valedictory. The McGuires were always glad to run into any of us. They were probably glad to see our backs, too.
Okay, now we're something else is coming right up, our narrator. Why does she say that?
About the backs?
There's no real connection.
Yeah.
It's
just a passing.
Right. Cordial.
Right. But. And also...
And they vanished. They didn't say anything to anybody.
Yeah, yeah. And they didn't say anything to anybody, and they chose to leave, mm-hmm. right? They chose to leave this little community or whatever. So we hear a little bit of hostility coming from our narrator. Ruth, do you want to keep going?
Sure. You are a maiden lady, the school doctor reminded me some months later. We have grown old together. He says what he pleases. Marriage is a private mystery. I'm told that parents feel vacant when their children have flown. Most couples just stay here and crumble together. Who knows, he shrugged. I'm a maiden lady myself. The few people who saw Keith and Mitsuko waiting for the trolley that September morning assumed they were going off on a camping trip. Certainly they were properly outfitted, each wearing a hiker's back frame fitted with a sleeping bag and a knapsack. The most popular theory is that they have settled in some other part of the country. There they work, Keith with steel and flame, Mitsuko with the electronic will-o'-the-wisp. There they drink avocado shakes and read paperbacks.
Some fanciful townspeople whisper a different opinion, that when the McGuires shook our dust from their hiking boots, they shed their years too. What is that? Shook our dust from their hiking boots.
Done with that part of their life. Mm-hmm. And those people that they knew onto something else.
Right, right. They have indeed started again elsewhere, but rejuvenated, restored. So that shedding of the dust is like, you know, let's leave that behind in a kind of conscious way, in a way that could make her feel rejected, which she does. Mitsuko's little breasts are already swelling in preparation for the expected baby. I reject both theories, maiden lady that I am. I believe solitude to be not only the unavoidable human condition, but also the sensible human preference. Keith and Mitsuko took the trolley together, yes, but I think that downtown they enacted an affectionate, though rather formal, parting in some public place, the bus depot, probably. Keith then strode off. Okay, so here's what I'd like you to do. With the person next to you, talk about two things. One is, what is this ending about? What's the meaning of this ending? And number two, what's this story about?
Oh boy.
Go to it. And then we'll reassemble.
Was she saying they separated?
I know, there was another. But I didn't know that was a figure.
There was another. Yeah.
Yeah, I was very
puzzled by that. And the other thing I thought was, I don't know, the whole hour talking about it. So what do we think?
And then I was trying to think where to bring someone on the board.
I'm not sure. What was the
second question?
Oh, just what is the story trying to teach us, tell us, the message, or messages?
I just couldn't figure it out. I didn't know if I was going to talk to her. I don't know if that was the vibe or the way she wrote it.
So I think that's fans of her town.
I was trying to think of it.
I think she's the one.
Yeah, I know. She's
the other color. She's just kind of placed in there.
I'm trying to figure out.
I don't like that the reason she wrote it.
Okay. All right.
People
when you're ready. Okay. The end. What is the end about?
We have no idea.
Some suggestions. Okay. Let's talk about what is this story about, and then we'll get to. Options. What do you mean by that, Harry?
They presented at the end of the story three different options mm-hmm. of how you can go on in your life.
Mm-hmm.
And the what I thought the most interesting part is our narrator clearly has a preference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So this is my take on it. It's not based on, you know, anything I read or whatever, but I think Edith Perlman is pulling a little bit of a fast one on us, because this is not a story about the Maguires. It's a story about the narrator. And, you know, it's when one person looks into another person's life, what do they see? You know? And so our narrator is looking into this person's life, and what she does, which we all do, and particularly at the end, they're filling in the gaps. Right. They don't know what happened to Keith and Mitsuko. So we come up with the ending of the story. We always do that. And it gets us into trouble because we make assumptions about people, you know, and but I think she's also writing about writing. So, you know, the narrator, if it's a story about the narrator, basically, you know, she's telling us two things. One is, when we look at other people's relationships and, you know, and so on, we have to do that with a degree of humility, because the truth is we know nothing about them. I mean, I don't mean that literally. But, you know, there are, even if you are close to somebody, sometimes there are experiences that are not shared with you. And so, yeah.
There's always something that goes on. You can't see what goes on behind closed doors.
Right. And then she's also telling us that the eyes that are looking are very significant, right, to how we tell the story. Because she's interested, but she doesn't try to become an intimate with them either, you know. She's just kind of, you know, looking at it from the outside. And as Harriet said, she has her particular preference.
Says when she's a maiden lady, that she's older, that she's unmarried.
I took it to be unmarried.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So she doesn't even have experience of a relationship to know even.
That's the whole thing. The bride of veil is not solid.
Right.
Well, it could be. Statement in the next to last paragraph. I believe solitude to be not only the unavoidable human condition, but also the sensible human preference. So she's projecting her preferences onto assumptions about them.
Right. And so that last option, what is Keith doing?
We don't know. I mean,
he's striding off.
Yeah, he's starting. Her theory is that, you know, he's choosing solitude, right? Yeah, he's choosing, right. And, you know, and of course, we don't know. But the thing is, go ahead.
There's nothing in the story that would make her think that at the end they would move off in separate directions.
No, right. So it's what she's bringing to the story.
But they also use, like, country western song stuff in here. Yes. I thought this woman has a really good sense of humor. I mean, they're really funny. She's shaking the dust. He's striding off. They're hiking boots. And I thought, she's playing with that one. She's just really enjoying herself.
Right, out into the sunset. And we don't know anything that they're going out into the sunset.
Yes.
But in this sense, I think this is very Edith Perlman. Barry, did you want?
What struck me is that it causes one to think about what's the nature of belonging? You know, all these people live in this community, but without the sense that although this couple did the required things, they really, not only did they not make a connection and feel like they belonged there because it was so easy to just pick them up, but I don't think the people around them, they did not get into each other's lives. She seems to be in everybody's lives. So she may like solitude, but she belongs in this community, I think, because apart from the solitude, she knows what's going on.
Very interested.
That's a different kind of a connection. I mean, I don't know that you can just denigrate the couple's connections with the neighborhood. I mean, it was just different than her. She was a teacher. She's a teacher, so she knew more about what the kids brought to her. And she heard what she got from the school nurse. Oh, doctor, everyone. doctor, I don't know. Because that added to the information that she got from them. But I don't know that they were so totally disconnected from the community.
Right. It's possible that they were actually deeply enmeshed in the community. She is what we call. Right.
That
she knows.
We don't know about the cordial neighbors that they knew.
No, she's what we call an unreliable narrator. And there's a purpose. Uh-huh. There's a purpose to having an unreliable narrator.
Well, she keeps emphasizing their differences. Their differences in background, their differences in size, their differences in interests. And she just doesn't get it. She can't understand.
Right. Yeah.
Well, she also says many people knew the Maguires. How could they not, with the boys going to school and making friends and playing sports? So there were people who, may have been apprised of their leaving, first of all, just because she wasn't.
But
also what Barry said kind of struck me, because when I lived in Louisville, Kentucky, it was a very insular community. It was the kind of community that no matter how long you had been there, if you hadn't been there and grown up there, you didn't have those connections with people. And so it could be that this was that type of a community.
Very much so. It could be that they were, you know, in many ways shut out. It could be that they were deeply involved. And we don't know because of our narrator, because everything really that we've said here could go both ways.
Mm-hmm. The other thing is that for those of us in the room who have moved from one place to mm-hmm. the other, there is a tremendous resentment of when you tell people you're leaving, which I found actually rather incredible the first time I experienced it. Mm-hmm. It's I think complicated. They would like to do it and don't have whatever the needs are to actually do it. They resent your leaving them, and so I think that that's part of what's in this narration, mm-hmm. is that here they were 25 years part of the community, and they just left. How could they do that? Right. So that's, yeah.
Right. And so what Edith Perlman does in most of these stories, except for this one, is what she does is she gives us a reliable narration of the story. And it's in the details. It's in all of these details. They grew vegetables, you know. And she somehow, she'll peel the layer of something ordinary, the ordinary thing that they did, and she'll show us how it's not ordinary at all, that it was a shared garden by two people who, you know, whatever. You know, there are a million things that we don't know about a vegetable garden. She'll show us, like, she takes us into families and so on. I don't think this is about patting herself on the back, that I'm your reliable narrator. Mm-hmm. I just took this as, we need to approach, she needs to approach her readers, and we need to approach our friends and community members and so on with a degree of humility about what we know and what we don't know about their lives. And the best way to know is to ask them, you know, because otherwise, you know, we make assumptions, we guess, we this, we that. So here's I've given you parts of this before, but because it spoke to this story, I really wanted to look with you. It's a beautiful piece. This is James Wood in the New Yorker. He's talking about Edith Perlman.
Thank you.
And this is a review of Honeydew, but he tells us some very important things about her and her. Yes.
It's so interesting that he's not a reliable narrator. Rely upon what the narrator is saying. Where are you? And she said, none of us knew them well. They didn't become anyone's intimates. If we take that to mean, how do you know that, etc., right. then what do you right. believe in terms of what she's saying? And how do you discriminate between a statement that seems on its face, okay, she knows the town, she knows, and do you know, then you reread it and say, wait a minute, God bless you. Whose perception is this? Is
right.
this what she's saying? It is?
Right. Okay, so perfect. Let's listen to this. It's the answer to your question, Barry. No. Okay. Many of Edith Perlman's short stories involve characters who are listening to others or spying on them, the twin conduits, the detail-rich supply lines of this subtle writer's system. Listening is, or should be, intimate, while spying is usually more estranged. Perlman's short fiction is interested for the ways in which it combines proximity and distance. I love that line because I think it's proximity and distance. People are closely attended to and swiftly evoked amid the engrossing particulars of life. And engrossing particulars, that's what she's so good at. Clothes, households, parents, children, dailiness of all kinds. But Perlman can also move back from characters in order to see the entire span of their lives. Then she becomes one of God's spies, mm-hmm. condensing a life into a few sentences, taking on the power of prophecy, knowing, as Psalm 121 says, "You're thy going out and thy coming in," right? It's only God has the real picture of this. So just turn to the next slide. And it's 1, 2, 3. Um, Oh, yeah, okay. Well, she says, it is Perlman who gives us the godlike power to peer down the long, dizzying corridors of their lives. Perlman's dearest subject may indeed be adequate happiness. Adequate happiness. She is interested in sustainable marriages, in feasible relationships, functional contentment, whatever will last a lifetime, and seeing death steadily and calmly as life's predicate, as the dark backing on the other side of the mirror. The necessary obverse is an essential element of that wisdom. And this is from that beautiful story, Blessed Harry. What counted was how you behaved while death let you live and how you met death when life released you. That was the long and short of it. Actually, Ruth, do you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. To me, a short story is a conversation between writer and reader, Perlman has said. Since only the writer can speak, she must take care to respect the reader, to avoid telling him what to think, to say as little as possible and imply the rest with metaphor, ellipses, elusive dialogue, pauses. It is a conventional enough literary assumption, but in her hands it produces singular work, in which an adult writer, full of parental tact, yet throbbing with restrained tenderness, treats both her characters and her readers as adults. These days, it seems almost radical.
The respect for the reader, which comes through, you know, pretty much in every story. To avoid telling him, you know, she said, talk about the taking the time to be brief. She's talking about, and short stories must be this way. It's about restraint. It's about how you contract, a story into a small space. What is it that I wanted to say about this? There it was. Sorry, turn back. Fascination with the complicated world of adults and with the difference between seeing and understanding. Though with the sober qualification that most adults see through a glass no less darkly than children, it is the writer who sees everything, hears everything, and reserves the right to fiddle with the aperture. Perlman's fiction brings together uncanny wisdom, short views and long views, the hours of our lives and the lengths of our lives. She is tender and distant at once. The frequent result is distinctive wittiness, a lightness and swiftness of tone familiar to readers of Muriel's work. But that part about seeing and understanding, you know, seeing and understanding. Yeah.
I think that's also the dilemma with reading her. If I were taking this book on an airplane with me, or Honeydew, I would just be reading it. I'd be reading story after story. It's not a closed reading. It's you know, you're reading for enjoyment, whatever. And you get a feeling for it. But it would be cloudy because you wouldn't have any of the details.
Right.
So I don't know what I would think of it then.
Yes, yes.
In the same way.
No, totally. That's right. Because if you think of the feeling, sometimes I ask myself after I read, what's the feeling of the story? This wasn't a happy one. This wasn't like a, you know, it was frustrating in so many ways because you didn't know which way to go. You know, you didn't know. I mean, that's just what kept coming home to me. I don't know anything about them. I know a little bit about the narrator.
But when you don't dissect in your mind, right, you're not doing a close reading and you're just reading it, what you have is that sort of wash of some type of feeling or emotion that goes through you when you read something. And I'm not sure it would sustain me. Would I want to read the next four stories?
Exactly.
You know, I'm not sure. I read that Large Lady because I thought it was for today that I read this one. I looked it up on her. And I thought, huh? You know, I finished and went, what?
Yeah, I read it too.
I said, okay, I have to read it again, but I don't read things again. I mean, generally, or, you know, at least on an airplane. Right.
We always say after each read, God, saw so much more in this story than we ever possibly could have alone. So I think that's what you're saying.
There's
a much different analysis.
I think I certainly
I would definitely appreciate her style in the sense of how she, the words she puts together, the thoughts she puts together in a sentence. I'm not sure if I'd appreciate the whole short story. That's right. Different. Mm-hmm. That's telling. Without a doubt, I love right. the words.
Right. So
or combo, you know, two or three or four right. words together.
Right. So, you know, I read, you know, I'm preparing for class, so I read the story, you know, 10 times. But I think the difference is that now, because I've read her and because I'll give her the benefit of the doubt, you know, like, you know, I mean, there have been too many stories that have been, you know, whoever said it, life-changing, for me not to, you know, sort of, okay.
Well, you know to read slower now. I mean,
yeah.
But also, mm-hmm. when I read short stories, I don't read them in a row. I stop and I read it and I let it go. And her stories, for me, are like listening to a really interesting piece of music, and the music lingers in my head after I read. I can't tell you I get any more out of it, but I know that it keeps spinning in my head for a while, particularly if I read them and I wait a day. I don't. There's too much, it's like poetry, there's too much condensation to be able to read them sequentially.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
I actually came to really like this story because really from a, you know, sort of an ethical perspective, I just think that message of, you know, of being really a little bit humble about, you know, the judgments that we make about other people based on a very limited amount of information. I think that's such an important thing for us to remember.
Didn't you speak about, I heard you spoke about that in Rosh Hashanah, right?
I did. It's on the brain. It's on the brain. Okay, so the large lady next time. And, yeah.
She's thinking about moving to Seattle.
Oh, what does she do?
Right now she's working at Crayon Barrel.
I know, I wish you well.
Let me know.
Painting.
Are you in pain?
I noticed a little bit of bruising. Yeah.
This is over a week.
Oh my gosh. Do you feel okay?
She's lucky she didn't break it.
Right. I know, it's scary.
Usually when I'm falling, you know, enough to put a hand down.
She just fell.
It was so fast.
When do your folks come in?
A week from Wednesday.
They're coming the same time I am.
Maybe you'll be on the same
day. I don't think so.
And all of my children are coming for Thanksgiving.
Oh, how fun.
What a lovely thing.
Oh, how lovely.
How fun. And your parents
are coming.
That's awesome. Oh, how fun. And a week from Wednesday, your folks will be here. Their apartment will be ready.
No, they're going to stay with us for about a week. The movers will come about a week after.
That's perfect.
Yeah, no, it's perfect. It's perfect.
That's perfect.
How fun.
Yeah.
How totally fun.
Yeah. And really,
can't
wait for them to get here.
That's going to be great. That's going to be great. They're so wonderful. So we get them in our community.
We do.
Now, will they stay with you on Shabbat?
Yes. I think most of the time. And sure, sometimes they'll take a weekend off.
Yeah, well, that's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You might need a weekend off every now and then, too.
But generally, yeah, they'll come to us for Shabbos, which is
nice. Very nice. Are they still driving? Is somebody still driving?
My mother still drives. Yeah. So she can get them around. Although she won't drive at night anymore. Yeah.